You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Japan's imperial occupation of China caused massive death, destruction, and suffering. The Soviet Union's occupation of Afghanistan brought havoc. Foreign invasion and occupation of countries invariably arouses bitterness and resistance. Conquerors are never welcomed with flowers. But how many years did Imperial Japan occupy China, and how many years did the Soviets occupy Afghanistan? Not 40 years. But this June marks 40 years of Israel's military invasion and occupation of Palestinian lands in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. To analyze that occupation, I'm joined on the phone by Dr. Nasir Arouri. He was born in Jerusalem, and he's the emeritus professor at the University of Massachusetts. Dr. Arouri is a leading Palestinian intellectual, author of many books on the Middle East, and a human rights activist. Good morning, Nasir.
Good morning, Mordechai. How are you?
Fine, thanks. Now, popular consciousness in Canada and the United States is dominated by the claim that Israeli existence was at stake in 1967, and it only invaded and occupied Palestinian territories to defend itself. What does recent historical scholarship, including Israeli, have to say about that presentation?
Well, it says that to claim that it was an existential phenomenon, I think, is a hoax, particularly when you have generals who participated in that war who said that at no point was Israel's existence being threatened. And therefore, it was not really a war imposed on the Israelis, but rather a war of choice. One such general who said explicitly that Israel's existence was not threatened is Mattathiah Pellad, who made many appearances in North America during the 1970s, and he talked about that war and reaffirmed the fact that it was a war of choice. Secondly, let me just say that when one looks at the results of that war, it could not have possibly been imposed on Israel, given the geostrategic change that it has created in the area. I mean, the target of that war was a movement, an Arab nationalist movement led by Nasser. By the end of that war, Nasser was reduced to a nothing, I mean, to a pathetic figure, and Nasserism was undone by the former President Sadat, who succeeded Nasser, and the Palestinians were isolated, the Arabs were in disarray, there was fragmentation in the area, and the war actually served the strategic interests not only of Israel for a while, but the United States as well. So the United States looked at it as something that benefited it strategically. But when one looks to the long range, you see that the U.S. has really suffered a great deal because there is outrage in the area nowadays and then. In other words, the roots of the outrage which we see today with American policy in the area have begun with that war and because of that war. So there was no way that this was a war of necessity.
Can you identify any distinct stages in the evolution of Israel's occupation from its initial invasion in June of 1967 to the present?
Well, you know, when we look at occupation, and you gave a lovely introduction about occupations, mentioning certain others in China, Tibet, etc., I think that the Israeli occupation is almost unique, not only because it is the longest occupation that we are looking at and in modern history, but because it is not really an occupation in the international law sense of the term. I mean, occupation is a phenomenon of international law. There is an occupant who occupies, and there are occupied people, both of whom have rights and privileges. The occupier normally has certain privileges of security. All of this is premised on the assumption that there must have been really causes for the occupation, and it would last normally for as long as it is necessary, not terribly long, but at least when the causes that brought it about have ceased to exist. Not so with the Israeli occupation. The Israeli occupation was calculated in terms of the strategic map, geopolitical map of the region, and it was actually one of the first acts, the early acts, of trying to redo, to remap or reshape that strategic map. I think it would be more accurate to say that this is a form of politicide rather than occupation. And the Israeli sociologist Baruch Kimmerling wrote about politicide. In fact, he has a book by that term, by that title. And in his book, he defined politicide as a process that has as its ultimate goal the dissolution of the Palestinian people's existence as a legitimate national, social, or economic entity, which may also include partial or total ethnic cleansing. This is vastly different from occupation that is temporary. In other words, the intent of this occupation is politicized, is to ensure that the Palestinians will not be able to exercise any sort of self-determination on any of the territory that lies between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean Sea. And there is a consensus with regard to this in the Israeli body politic, meaning that the right and the left, what used to be Labor, Likud, and others, are all in agreement that there is no room for two sovereign states in the area between the river and the sea. When we began to see the expansion of Israel, the creation of settlements in the 1970s when Likud first came to power, it was continued with Labor. So the argument that Labor doesn't really want to rule over Arabs is not true. I mean, what we saw in Oslo in 1993 and beyond was ensuring that the occupation would continue, but it would be repackaged and renamed. So it is politicized rather than occupation, and I think that we've been seeing it in the various acts of the Israelis all the way up to last week when they abducted the top officials of Hamas. It is all part of a process called politicide.
So if that is the overarching Israeli objective, is it the case then that that objective has eliminated the possibility of a two-state solution, or are there other factors at play in the region that would still make that a viable option?
I'm afraid so, Mordechai. I think that this is quite correct, unfortunately, I think there is no room for the two-state solution anymore. I don't think that it has really been seriously on the table in any case. I think that the peace process, which is supervised by the Americans for more than three decades, has been a process that was not really meant to bring peace. How can so many presidents, how come so many secretaries of state can really fail over a period of four decades in bringing about peace when they assume that they are the honest broker? This was not so. I mean, the Zionist movement intends to have a large state in historic Palestine, and I think that this is sustained, this has been sustained both by the U.S. and by the various components of the Israeli body politic. So the peace process, which ceased to exist, by the way, I mean, at least that there was a semblance of it all these decades, but with Bush too, I think it even ceased to exist. The Palestinians are told that if you want a peace process, if you want to come back to the table, and we're not really promising anything concrete on the table, but we're talking about a table. If you want to come to a table, the purpose of which is not well defined, then you have to meet certain conditions. You would have to give up resistance. Resistance in the nomenclature used by the U.S. and Israel is terrorism. So you have to stop being terrorists, meaning you have to stop resistance. You have to, secondly, give up the right of return for the refugees, whose right of return has been reaffirmed repeatedly by the United Nations and other international bodies. Thirdly, you have to give up Jerusalem, your claims on Jerusalem. And fourthly, you have to accept a fragmented entity. There'll be no contiguity, no sovereignty, as I mentioned, in the area between the river and the sea.
So if the two-state solution is no longer realistic, never was the intention of Israel in any case or America to achieve, what remains as the goal?
What remains are three alternatives, some of which are ominous, some of which are likely to take a long, long time. But these three alternatives, one would be ethnic cleansing, and that is a continuation of what happened in 1948, when more than two-thirds of the Palestinian nation became refugees. So one would be ethnic cleansing. The second one would be apartheid, which is formalizing the ongoing process that is occupied, that is being practiced by Israel today under the name politicide, as I mentioned it and defined it, relying on Kimmerling's definition. And the third one would be to live together in peace and equality, where the equality and dignity of every single human being, irrespective of the religion of his mother or father, in all of Palestine, would be guaranteed. And I'm talking about a single state based on the equal protection of the law, as in the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. I think that these are the only possible three alternatives. The two that I mentioned first are terribly ominous, and I think that the only alternative that is going to assure dignity in the long run and equality for everybody is the single state. So it's ironic that the architects of Oslo may have inadvertently paved the road to the single state.
Well, thank you for speaking with us this morning, Nasir, and I look forward to your public lecture in Vancouver.
You're very welcome. I'm looking forward to it, too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I've been speaking with Dr. Nasir Arouri. He's a leading Palestinian intellectual and human rights activist. He's going to be in Vancouver on Wednesday, June 6th, to speak at the Central Vancouver Public Library on Georgia Street. The meeting is at 7 p.m. in the Alice McKay Room, and Dr. Arouri's topic is 40 years of occupation and the prospects for peace.